Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of A Trophy Life Podcast. I'm your host, Bob Rathbun, greeting you from Atlanta. And as we get going, our weekly hope and prayer is that you and yours are well and healthy and getting through this as we hopefully inch closer to the resumption of the professional basketball season. And we wrap up our time with The Last Dance, and that's going to be the subject of our podcast here today. Plus, we have a couple of news and notes for you as well. Our sponsor this week is Jersey Mike's, a great friend of the club. And at Jersey Mike's, they offer a sub above, one that's measured in more than inches or seconds till served. Jersey Mike's carefully considers every aspect of what they do, every slice, every sandwich, every store. They seek to provide their customers with sustenance and substance, too. It has been on the minds of basketball fans over these last 5 weeks, and that is, of course, The Last Dance, the documentary through the eyes of Michael Jordan as they relive the final championship season of 1997-1998, and the ratings, astronomical. They finished strong. Episodes 9 and 10 last weekend averaged 5.6 million viewers across ESPN and ESPN2, and the original airings of all 10 episodes of the series also averaged 5.6 million viewers that same day of airing, so that has cemented The Last Dance as the most-watched documentary content ever on ESPN. So with that in mind, we thought it would be kind of neat this week to talk to a great friend of the Atlanta Tip-Off Club, the Naismith Awards, Will Perdue. You saw him on The Last Dance. He was a part of the Bulls' first three of six Michael Jordan championship teams, was traded to San Antonio in 1995 for Dennis Rodman, became an NBA champion for a fourth time in 1999 with the Spurs, and many of you remember Will as a terrific college player at Vanderbilt. He was the SEC Player of the Year back in 1988 and then was on to the pros the very next season, breaking in with those Chicago Bulls. So a lot to talk about with Will. We caught up with him as he was driving around the Windy City of Chicago. So time for this week's interview with Will Perdue of the Bulls. Well, it's great to have Will Perdue on the line with us from the Windy City of Chicago, a terrific friend of the Naismith Awards and the Atlanta Tip-Off Club. Will, you're a media darling now, if you weren't already. Boy, we've been seeing your mug on TV left and right. How you doing?
Well, Bob, I'm doing well. I've kind of joked over the last 5 weeks, I'm kind of reliving my 15 minutes of fame now that I'm in my 50s. So good thing is I haven't lost my voice yet. And I try to tell people, you know, we had an opportunity to get a screening of everything that was going on so we could watch the episodes in advance. And I elected not to do that because I've been watching most of them with my son, who's 16. So he wasn't, you know, obviously he wasn't alive at the time, did not get to see me play. So I wanted to watch with him, and I kind of, you know, wanted to see his reaction, see what he took away from it. And as I've joked, I've got a little more street cred now with the teenage population.
And that's very important. What was his reaction to what he saw?
It's been interesting to hear him talk about just how the game is so much different back then, because they're used to what they see now with the free-flowing offense and the importance of the three and, you know, analytics. And it's a different ball game. And I asked him if he didn't like the way it was played. He said, nah. I said, I would like to see a combination of how to talk about how he thought there was so much more of an emphasis on defense back then than there is now.
Interesting. Well, of course, for those who watched these 10 episodes over the last 5 weeks, we have all been just mesmerized with the behind-the-scenes looks. As you viewed it, was it pretty realistic in your mind? Did they capture the essence of what Jordan and this Bulls run of six titles in 8 years is all about?
I think they did a really good job, as a matter of fact. You know, I was doing some radio in Chicago over these last 5 weeks, and we actually had on the producer. And he talked about that at no time did Michael Jordan ever tell him that he couldn't put something in. He told him that he had to take it out. He never did that. He actually even called And unfortunately for the Atlanta Hawks organization, the only thing he changed was his people called on his behalf, and they had him add a scene, or should we say add a highlight, to where the part about when he came back from baseball, you know, they had the part about the Knicks and the 55-point game. He says, well, hey, I'd also like you to put in the game against the Atlanta Hawks when I played well and hit a game-winning shot against them, because I thought that was part of the process of me getting back and me becoming, you know, the Michael Jordan that I expected. Outside of that, he didn't, you know, as many people saw, you know, I had some pretty colorful things to say regarding Michael, but not, you know, in a way that I was trying to be degrading, just trying to help people understand what it was like. And he didn't flinch at that. He said they were surprised that he just kind of looked ahead and said, yeah, that's good. Because I think Michael really wanted people to walk away from this understanding, you know, okay, obviously, how good was he really? B, how difficult was it to be him? Not just him, the player, but him, the person. The challenges that he faced on an everyday basis, but also the levels and the accountability that he held himself to be the person that he was, and just how hard it is to be that good that often. I mean, literally, I think as you saw, Bob, I mean, over your career, how many times have you actually seen Michael play poorly?
Yeah, very few.
And I think that he takes pride in that, and a lot of it had to do with because of just how he approached the game, both mentally and physically.
And I thought, Will, that watching these 10 episodes for the younger players, the guys that are in the league now that really don't know and have a feel for what it was like back then, they are seeing what true athletic competition, hatred in an athletic form, is really all about, and paying that price to be not just a winner, but to be a champion. And to see that reflected through the eyes of Michael Jordan has really been an eye-opener for the younger players in the NBA and in those guys, I'm sure, that are in college now and high school, because you don't see that today. You know, there's everybody hugs and kisses before the tip-off, and, you know, you just don't have that. The game has changed, and though your guys and your time, you had your time, these guys are having their time, but it is a difference, and it's great to see, I think, for them to see how the game was played back then and how the game was approached. Don't you?
I agree with you 100%. You know, the one thing I try to share with people, and I've been doing these interviews and podcasts and everything, is that first and foremost, and I think this has changed. I think the mentality has changed. I think the approach to the game has changed. And more specifically about from the players and how they're treated, than more so than the coaches and the organizations. But I remember when I came into the league in 1988 when I was drafted, my main goal was to earn the respect of the players on my team, my coaches, and the players that I played against, whether I liked them, whether they liked me. I wasn't too concerned about that. I was more concerned about the respect aspect, meaning I was putting in the time, I had the work ethic, I had the right mentality, I had the right approach, you know, I had patience, I had perseverance. You know, I was more concerned about making sure that you know, we were on the same page in that manner than I was concerned about being on the same page as far as, hey, man, we're friends, we're tight. I thought that would come naturally after the respect aspect. That's what I was more concerned about. But I learned that being at Vanderbilt, but I also learned it from John Paxson and Bill Cartwright and obviously Michael Jordan, veterans who had been in the league for a few years when I got there. I thought that as a league-wide policy, was more important than friendship, than being liked. And I think that's where I think things have turned a little bit. Guys, you know, are a little more sensitive. They're more concerned about, you know, the relationships they have with players off the floor. And, you know, it's just a different approach. I'm not saying they're not as good or even better, but I'm just saying mentally and emotionally, players are just different.
Will, you won those first three titles before getting traded to San Antonio, and of course the guy that traded you was Jerry Krause. Do you feel like he was depicted fairly? Because we've seen a lot of some criticism with the way he's been portrayed, because in his passing he hasn't been allowed an opportunity, of course, to defend himself like so many others have in the documentary. What's your take on the treatment of Jerry?
Well, I thought they should have shown both sides. Not only just talk about Jerry Krause, the general manager. The biggest problem that I have with this whole documentary, and it's not, it's like a huge problem where I feel like it's necessary to stand up and be heard, but when I'm asked, I try to give an honest answer. Jerry Krause was not a people person. That he struggled to convey his true feelings, which is obvious when, you know, he was, the excerpts they did use of the press conferences, he didn't get along with the media. He thought that the media was the devil. And, you know, he made a mistake. And I wish he was here to defend himself and say why he made this statement. Even Jerry Reinsdorf has come up and said that Jerry Krause made a mistake when he talked about before the 98 season, Phil will not be back next year. You know, even if he goes 82 and up, that wasn't appropriate. It wasn't necessary, but that was more of a defense mechanism, an emotional response to, you know, what he thought was being attacked by the media. There, you know, the quote of, there's no backstabbing going on here. But what people didn't realize was, you know, how good of a person he was behind the scenes. He cared about the players. He cared about the organization, quite honestly, more than he did his family. And his main concern was winning championships. And he did that. And regardless of how much you like him, regardless of how much he's being depicted in this documentary, he was the main reason. Yes, Michael Jordan was already there before he got there. But everybody else that was there, including Phil Jackson and his coaching staff and every other player, was there because of Jerry Krause. Jerry Krause brought in everybody and put in the right system, Tex Winter's triangle, by bringing Tex Winter on as an assistant to Phil Jackson, to Scottie Pippen, who he made a draft day trade with the Seattle Supersonics to get Scottie Pippen instead of Olden Polonese, to picking Horace Grant, to B.J. Armstrong, to myself. I mean, you have to give him the necessary credit, regardless of what you think about him. I know a lot of people look at him, you know, as Darth Vader, but, and that's unfortunate. But I wish they would have also been a little more detail-oriented as far as talked about more about Jerry Krause, the person, than Jerry Krause, you know, just the general manager, who a lot of people want to villainize and say was the reason why they weren't given the opportunity to try to defend their title for the 98-99 season.
It was nice to see Scottie Pippen acknowledge that in the end.
It really was. And listen, Scottie was also the one that delayed his surgery because he didn't like the fact they wouldn't renegotiate a new contract. That was just
right.
An organization policy. Scottie was, you know, not, he wasn't considered to be Jerry's friend, but yet that was, you know, that was the right thing to do, but also he knew his voice would be heard if he said it more so than somebody else.
Well, Will, we talked about your trade to San Antonio, and even though you missed out on maybe the next three titles in Chicago, you were a part of that 99 team that won it. So four rings total, amazing career that you've had. But it's also given you the opportunity to play for two of the winningest coaches of all time. And I'd love to get your thoughts on comparing and contrasting Phil Jackson and Greg Popovich.
And let me answer the first part real quick before I get to the comparison. You know, when I first got traded, I was really disappointed because now that's the season after Michael had come back from baseball. He'd only played 25 games. We had lost to the Magic. That was also ultimate motivation for him, plus everybody else. We were jacked. We were ready to come back. That was also the summer of the lockout. So, you know, the agreement wasn't signed until the week before training camp was supposed to happen. So I get traded, you know, a week before training camp. Didn't have much preparation time. But come to find out, you know, I look back at it and I was traded for a Hall of Famer straight up. And it ended up being a win-win situation because of the things I learned about myself as a player and a person by going to San Antonio and developing a relationship with those players. But also one of the men you mentioned, Greg Popovich. And I always talk about, when you talk about two, they did an excellent job. And when I say they, I mean both of them, even though they took different approaches. Phil's approach was, okay, let me find out how I push Will Perdue's buttons or Horace Grant's buttons or B.J. Armstrong's buttons. It might have been more of a grading style, more abrasive, much like Michael was, than Greg Popovich, who was more about cultivating a relationship personally and professionally, so that he wanted to take the route of a different route of accountability. where Phil took, you know, as I just mentioned, his route of accountability. But they still got the best out of you. Pop wasn't necessarily looking to push my buttons, but he was looking to develop a relationship. So I knew that at all times I was doing what was best for me, but also what was best for the organization. There wasn't an ulterior motive. And that's how you develop that relationship, but also the motivation. That's different than what Phil did. Sorry, Bob, it was a different culture. Is Chicago was more businesslike, San Antonio was more family-like. But at the end of the day, both organizations won championships, but it just also goes to prove you can take a different approach. You don't have to take the same approach every single time to get the desired results.
But I was going to say, Will, it really speaks to your professionalism that you could excel under both styles, that you didn't have just one way that a coach would have to treat you to get the best out of you. Both approaches seemed to work well.
They did, and I was fortunate enough that I had in Chicago, I had Bill Cartwright, John Paxson, veterans that, you know, kind of looked out for me, taught me things off the floor, you know, told me, hey, what Phil's doing is not personal, you know, because you would try to remove your emotions from the situations, but sometimes your emotions get the best of you and you do things that you regret, that you know were wrong. But at the time, you know, you thought you got pushed over the edge and you had to respond, and you lash back instead of thinking about what you're going to say or what you're going to do. But at the end of the day, as you saw Bill Winnington say in the documentary, yeah, it was rough. It was tough. It was a difficult situation, but yet Michael got the desired results, and so did Phil. But as you talked about, so did Greg Popovich. I mean, I personally fit in better with the Greg Popovich style, but I also found a way to succeed in the Phil Jackson style. So, but that's also maturity, and I think a lot of that, quite honestly, Bob, had to do with, you know, me going to college for 5 years. I redshirted, so I was a little older when I came out. So I was able to handle it a little better.
Well, we can't let you get away without talking about your college experience, because I know MJ hit a lot of big shots, but so did Barry Goheen. And we got to talk about Barry, and we got to talk about this book of his. Of course, you are featured prominently, entitled Buzzer Beaters and Memorial Magic, that has come out this season. I have loved every second of it, watching you guys play back in the late 1980s at Vanderbilt. Of course, Barry's Buzzer Beaters. You're, of course, in your last year was the first of the 2 years that he talks about in the book. But talk a little bit about Vandy and that experience. You were such a terrific college player, SEC, obviously, Player of the Year, and drafted out of Vanderbilt into the NBA. A little bit about your experience and your relationship with Barry.
Well, I can honestly say that I don't feel sorry for LeBron James or Kevin Garnett or Kobe Bryant, you know, Tracy McGrady, guys that went straight from high school. It was a choice they made, and I thought they should have that choice. But what they missed out on was a part of life that they can't get, that I feel like I have, that they never had, an experience that they didn't have. They have great relationships from their high school friends and their teammates in the NBA, but it's really hard to put into words the relationships that you develop, the bonds that you have with your teammates in college. And, I still have really good relationships with my teammates that I played with in Chicago and the guys that I played with in San Antonio, but I probably have deeper, more lasting, meaningful relationships with the guys that I played with in college, most notably, you know, Barry Goheen being one of them. And the interesting thing is that, you know, my relationship with Barry is probably better now than it was when we played, and not because I disliked him. We were just, you know, we were a little different. We had different personalities. We had different approaches to the game. And when people are like, well, what are you talking about? You know, Barry, we used to joke that Barry's preparation in the off season is Barry never had to take summer school. So he never came to summer school. So we used to joke about Barry, would you, in the summer, Barry's preparation for the next season was he played softball. We're like, you did what? Like, yeah, I played softball. You know, Barry loves baseball. He loves the Cardinals. He loves the Braves. But I was like, well, no, I came to summer school because, A, I had to, because, you know, I wasn't necessarily the brightest student, but I chose Vanderbilt for a reason, because my mom hammered home education, you know, and I went to, and my schools that I visited were Vanderbilt, Purdue, Virginia, Georgia Tech, all academic institutions, because of what my parents thought was important first and foremost. And they also loved C.M. Newton. But, you know, I became a basketball junkie, and I know people don't want to hear this, because it is important to go somewhere where you feel like an education is important. But at the end of the day, you go somewhere, your final decision comes down to who's the head coach. How do I feel I'll fit in with that coach? What type of relationship will I have with that coach? And how does that coach sell their program to the parents? And C.M. Newton did an excellent job, and I can't be happier that I went there, prouder that I went there, and actually graduated with a degree. But the relationships that I've had with Barry Goheen and Steve Reese and Glenn Clem and Barry Booker, you know, those are the best times of my life. And I can proudly say that because of the relationships. Barry was a guy that was an unbelievable shooter. His timing was unbelievable. I think he had 6 game-winning shots in his career. Now, when you looked at him and watched him play, he wasn't the most gifted player athletically, but he just had a knack for doing the incredible. And that's one of those things, it's really hard to explain, not trying to be funny, but it was just, that's who he was. And that's, I think he did a nice job of depicting that in the book. I feel very honored that he had a whole chapter dedicated to me and, you know, some of the discussions we had back in the day. But it was just, again, that's one of those things, you go back and read that book and it's kind of a reminder of just how enjoyable college was. You know, you faced adversity and struggles, and yeah, we didn't win a championship, but, you know, I still have a lot of great memories and really strong bonds with the guys I played with.
I recommend this book so highly because I just, for all the things you were just talking about, the closeness of friendship and the trials and tribulations on and off the court, it's a great read. Buzzer Beaters and Memorial Magic. Has been available for a few months, and I'm glad that you've enjoyed it as much as we have, Will, because this is it's really a great read. And you can tell Barry's, you know, in his lawyering background, I mean, this thing is like a Supreme Court brief, the way that it's noted and everything to the letter, every quotation, every reference. It's just great. And, of course, Barry is our fearless leader at the Atlanta Tip-Off Club, and we're so grateful for him and what he does for basketball. But great to have you on, sir. Are we going back to work here in a few months?
Well, I certainly hope so. I'll keep my fingers crossed. You know, I hope that it's something that, as far as the NBA goes, that they can assure the health and the safety of these players so they can get back to playing, because that's what they really want to do. And also that they can figure something out at the college level as well. You know, right now there's a little question. You're seeing where some universities are announcing that they're going to be going back to campus and starting the fall semester. Some are saying that there's a good possibility it's going to be like they ended up this spring, online. So college football's in question. College basketball's in question. But I hope that we continue to push forward. I hope that science continues to provide the answers that we need and that we can get back to. It's never going to be the same normal that we've known it as in the past, but hopefully that we can get back to competing again and allowing, you know, these kids back on the court in the field.
Amen. And Will, to you and your family and to everyone listening, stay safe, stay healthy, and can't wait to see you soon up in Chicago. Thanks, Will.
Thank you, Bob.
Will, thank you. That was terrific. A couple of news and notes before we leave you this week, and this one is interesting in terms of the timing. Now, the Final Four men's basketball spots in the 12-nation field for the Tokyo Olympics will be decided next summer. It remains unclear, however, if those spots will be earned while the NBA season is happening or if NBA players will be allowed to take part. Now, FIBA has pushed back the dates for the 4 remaining qualifying tournaments to June the 29th through July the 4th of next year, meaning they would end 19 days before the rescheduled start of the delayed Tokyo Olympics. The host nations, Canada, Croatia, Lithuania, and Serbia, are unchanged. But If the 2021 NBA season starts later than usual, and I think that's a pretty good assumption, there are going to be some players like Giannis, like Nikola Jokic of Denver, that might be deep into the playoffs at that time next summer. Under normal circumstances, of course, NBA free agency would conflict with those dates as well. So there's a lot up in the air, and maybe some key players that need to help their countries make it to the Olympic Games might not be available. On the college front, we would like to send our congratulations to former NBA point guard Mo Williams. He is Alabama State's new head basketball coach. The historically black college announced his hiring last week. He spent 14 seasons in the NBA and was a part of the Cleveland Cavaliers' 2016 NBA championship squad. So congratulations to Mo Williams, the new head coach at Alabama State. And congratulations to our own Debbie Antonelli last weekend at her home in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. She did it again. 24 hours of making free throws. She made 2,400 shots, shooting 90% from the line, and raised over $100,000 for Special Olympics in South Carolina. Her 24-hour nothing but net, a massive success. Outdid herself this year and raised more money than she did last year when she was shooting inside a gym. This year it was out in the driveway at home, but raised six figures. And we send our congratulations out to Debbie and Frankie and the whole family. Congratulations. That's going to do it for this week. Once again, we'd like to thank our sponsor this week, Jersey Mike's. If you're hungry, why not get online? Time for a sub. You can order online. Their stores are open for takeout. You can also order on the app. And we thank Jersey Mike's as they're a terrific sponsor of our National High School Players of the Year, Coaches of the Year, and this year our new Courage Award. Thank you to Jersey Mike's, our sponsor this week. So that will do it for us from Atlanta. Wishing you safety out there. And we will rejoin you next week here on a Trophy Life podcast. For all of us here in Atlanta, Bob Rathbun saying so long.